This is Ashley Griffin with the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ Plus History Project. I am at the Roanoke Public Library on February 24th, 2018, and I am interviewing Miss Grace Kelly. Okay. So if you'd like to, you know, start with some background, your age, your name, where you grew up.
My name is Michael Kelly. I'm originally from Martinsville, but I moved to Roanoke in 76.
So what was your family dynamics like, your parents? Do you have any siblings, anything like that?
Yes.
How many siblings did you have?
I have four brothers and one sister.
Oh, that's a lot of boys.
Yes, one of them died.
So what was your early childhood like? You said you were from Martinsville.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like growing up there?
It was okay. You know, it had its moments, especially in high school. And a lot of boys make fun, and, you know. And plus I hung with a lot of girls. But it was okay, you know. I deal with things that went on and things. And I used to hang with a bunch of girls, and the boys knew that what time it was, you know, and they would say the little words and things, but it didn't affect me at all. Then later on, when I got around about the sophomore year, I was more accepted. And I tried out for drum majorette in high school, and it was five people, and they was laughing because I was the only boy that really came out to try it, and there was about four girls, and everybody had their turn to twirl, and when I came out the door, the band was standing there with their instruments, and I stepped out the door, and they says, "Here she come." I said, "Oh, my God." So I went on out and twirled through the baton up in the air, twirled it, and blew the whistle, and led the boys out on the field, the band on the field, and it was okay. They had lived. But the girls were tense, jade. But they got over it.
So is that something, like, I guess, I don't know what you would define your sexuality as, but is that something you sort of knew from a young age?
Oh,
that
yes.
You were more feminine?
Mm-hmm. You know how they say in the old days, mama's a baby and daddy's maybe.
So is that something that your family was comfortable with? Did they sort of encourage that, or did they, you know?
They accepted it. One brother didn't like it too well. And in my childhood, you know how it is on Christmas, you're expecting a doll and you get something, a green army truck. You get your face cracked up in the Christmas tree and things like that. So, about, I think I was around about 10 years old or 8, and my mama had bought me a G.I. Joe doll, and I was very disappointed because I expected Barbie. So I took and did the ordinary thing. I took and shaved, got some sandpaper, sand G.I. Joe's beard off, and caught one of my mama's wigs and glued him some hair, took his khakis and turned it into an evening gown. And my brother actually played with G.I. Joe. I had it covered up because I didn't want him to see what I had created. And he put the cover back and he seen G.I. Joe, so he was not a happy camper. And we got to knocking. And he didn't try me anymore because, you know, I gave him several gorilla knocks.
Is that something you found that you had to deal with more when you were younger? A lot of, like, teasing and stuff?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it. I mean, going out, trying to be a cuss, got wrong. That was a big disaster.
You wanted to be a Cub Scout?
Oh, I haven't done it. And I was not happy with that.
Really?
No.
Was it a difficult...
The boys were not prepared. Well, I had another friend that was just in the same boat I was, but I had a my school uniform, and we picked him up at his house, and everybody had a little blue uniform on, and they're ready to go, and then father was behind the wheel waiting, and we waited and waited, and the child came out, and oh, it was too many hemas. He came out, he had a garbage bag on for a dress, and tied two pieces of rope to his head for her and jumped right up in the car with us like that. So, you know, that was not They was not prepared for that madness. Then as I got older, things changed. And then the prom was a big disaster. I should have never volunteered to do that one.
Well, what happened with that?
Oh, well, the girl used me to get with another person. So I went ahead and went, you know, to impress everybody. So I went ahead and took her to the prom. And every time you turn around, she was getting up, getting punch. And I kept saying, well, why is she drinking all this punch? Knowing she was going to the room to meet her piece or whatever it was. So I said, when the fifth cup of punch comes through, I'm going to let her have it. So she came back and sat down. I said, did you have enough punch? She said, I said, okay. She said, well, we're going to the after prom party. I said, really? She said, yes, we're going. So I left her standing and left with a guy. And when she got to the prom party, we was over there in the corner sitting there and having a good time. And she walked to me and started growling. Why you do this? I said, well, why you kept getting up for punch? I said, I'm not stupid, honey. I didn't put my head on the green apple truck. I know what you was up to. So she didn't speak to me for a couple of years. Rather, I didn't care. And we ended up being best friends after all. And I moved out of my parents' house and moved over into the city part. And that's when I really got into, they was talking about drag. And I kept saying, drag, drag, what? And then that night, I ran some friends and they were dressed like women. And I said, oh, that's cool. And I thought, I said, well, I tried that madness. And I tried it and liked it. And then day one weekend, we decided to come to Roanoke. So we went to Roanoke to the horoscope, and I didn't know about the horoscope being a gay bar or whatever, and I went down there and went in. The music was booming outside, so this is going to be cute. And got up in there, and I saw terrible amounts of madness. I was truly cracked. My face was cracked like a Chinese soup bowl. So I went in, and it was just amazing. Men dancing, men, women dancing, women. I was, got right out on the dance floor, folded my arms, and looked around like this. I said, ooh. So, and then there was this female impersonator doing the show named Wilson, and came out on stage, and I thought it was a real woman. She entertained the crowd and everything, and I was amazed of how she did, performed and everything, and I like what I saw. And so the next day, we had stayed in a motel, and we went by her house to see her and knocked on her door early that morning, and ooh, the illusion had turned into a puff of smoke. She opened the door in Butch, and I can say, well, where is she? You know who, Dad? And she said, that's me right here. I said, ooh. So I went back to Martinsville. And later on, I came down one weekend, and I've been here ever since.
So you moved here around, like, the 70s?
I moved here around about 77.
So would you say that that night was, like, the defining night for you? Like, you just knew that that's what you wanted to do?
I knew when I saw the men dancing with women and the men dancing with men, I said, I cannot leave this place. And so I moved here, stayed at a boarding house. It was 1, 2, 3, 4, 8 of us in the boarding house. And the woman that took care of us, she was an older woman, and she was taught us a lot about dragging and all that. And I lived for living here, and I got with Wilson. And one night, we was going to the horoscope, and I said, I want to try one of those. So, I went to another bar. Was called the it was another bar called Traywind. And this is when I first got into drag. It was a gay bar, and straight and gay there. It was nice, you know. Everybody was getting along with each other. And I got in drag, and I tried, and I liked it. So I started doing shows there. And then back to the horoscope, I started getting into shows and stuff. And I saw my first drag pageant. And it was amazed. And about a couple of years later, I decided to get to run for the pageant, which was a big disaster. And I rang in, and it was okay, but the outfit that had made me, this child told us that she could sew beautiful gowns, which she didn't know what she was doing. She took a piece of blue satin material. She took and cut it down the side, sewed it and hemmed it at the bottom, put lace around the top, and took a disco shawl and wrapped it around my neck with a big brooch right here and said, swoop! So I stood out in front of the audience looking like a country bumpkin, blowed up, cracked, and it was okay until it got to talent. I did pretty good, and it just got to the point that I just got angry. So when all the contestants came out to line up, while they was lined up, I came through there with my suitcase, and out the door I went. And I started doing shows at the Horoscope, and then and later on, they was talking about the market. I said, the market. So we're down on the market, and there was cars everywhere, and there were drag queens on every corner, and I was saying, what kind of madness is this? And this way, everybody was prostituting. We don't call it that. We call it selling after hours produce.
After hours produce.
Yes.
Okay.
So got into that for years, and they had a lot of redneck bars and things downtown. A lot of people didn't like us because of the way we were. Some people accepted us for what we were. They had a restaurant called Billy's and Ritz, and we used to stand right across the street from that and the people would come down for dinner and it stayed packed. And we was wondering why, and they was coming down to see us stand there and carry on. And several years that went on, and then they had a lot of places. It was a new market. The Manhattan was redneck, and we finally, somehow, we knew the woman that owned it, and they started accepting us in those kind of places. There was the new market, the Manhattan, the Capitol, and that was Tony's, Miss Tony's. And they accepted us pretty well. Everybody got along and things. And then still performing at the Horoscope. And then I turned around, and when the Horoscope closed down, that was the park. And they didn't care for us when we first started going there. The butch guys didn't like the drag queens. And then we started fighting every time you go up in there. So they started giving us our respect. And we started doing shows there.
So you remember around when the Horoscope closed?
The Horoscope closed in 77. The park opened up in 77.
So you found a lot of difficulties when the park first opened? So
at first, I guess they weren't prepared. But, you know, it was some people that was accepting. Some of them wasn't, you know. And like I said, they would say those nasty comments, and then you have to reach out and touch in a rough way. And we gained our respect and everything. We started doing shows there, and it was okay.
Did that surprise you in any way, since, you know, you had performed at, like, the Horoscope and everything? Did it surprise you that the park sort of opened and wasn't as accepting when it first opened?
Mm-hmm. I wasn't surprised. I knew that, you know, some places didn't like drag queens, like Murphy's. They put up with drag queens. It was another gay bar downtown. And Murphy's was strange. They first started letting us in drag, and then later on they changed it. They told me you had to pull your wig off at the door and your breasts. And I was like, what in the world? That could have delusion. What would I look like going up in there with no breasts on my face, beat, and going up in like a big country onion with no makeup, with no hair? So I didn't like Murphy's, so I didn't go back to Murphy's no more. And then Last Straw was another gay bar, but it was totally butch. You couldn't go in drag. And then at the park, it was okay. And I saw my second pageant was at the, back then before I came here, that was Trade Winds, they started the Miss Gay Runner pageant, and that's when it was Carolyn Sue Wilson, Lee Cruz, Roger Hartberger, and some of them, they started a gay pageant. And back then, they had crowned Laura Hart, which was the first Miss Gay Roanoke. And then from there, they moved it to... From there, they moved it to the horoscope. And that's when Carolyn Sue Wilson was crowned Miss Gay Roanoke in 70... I think she was crowned in 75, if I'm not mistaken. And then later on, there was another queen. Her name was Stephanie Grant. She was crowned Miss Gay Roanoke there. And then later on, there was another one crowned Miss Gay Roanoke there at Harcup. Her name was Jennifer Jones. And then when they moved up to the park, they started up there, and I forgot it was. Stephanie Grant was given up her title.
Did you ever participate in Miss Gay Roanoke, or...
I'm a former Miss Roanoke at large. We have our own big girl pageant.
Yeah.
And I ran for Miss Roanoke at large in 1992, first time running. In 93, I ran, didn't run, so I set out a year, so I'm Miss Roanoke at large 94. And it was okay, you know, we still have our big girl pageants here in Roanoke.
Did you have that pageant because you didn't feel as accepted in the other one? Or was it just
easier? Well, once we got in the park and everything went okay, we decided to just go ahead and, since I was having Miss Gay Roanoke, we decided to get together and have our own big girl pageant. And back then it was fun. See, back then in the old days, girls pulled together and they weren't in their little cliques. But these days, the younger children, they'd have made it into a competition thing. Back in our days, we didn't do that. Everybody put guns, they had fun getting in drag, they helped each other, but they have some snobbish people, honey. The long ones are very disrespectful to the older girls. And sometimes you have to put them in their place. Because I had read one so bad to start crying, because she had came for me. She says, "Oh, you the flat, fat, black, mean one." I said, "Excuse you." I said, "Come in, let me give you some education, honey. As I paid for the way for you to have your you-know-what in here, as you must understand, we can't cuss in that, can you?"
It's up to you.
Okay. Well, I sat down and told him the whole gay history about this madness. I told him, I said, like this. I paid the way for you to bring your monkey fat in here. I said, "I was doing drag when you was in your daddy's..." "So don't come for me." So the child went out there and cried, and everybody was asking what happened. They said that she got nasty with Miss Grace and she put it in her place. But, you know, it's a shame that how things can change over the years, because the acceptance for us older queens, like at the park up here now, there's no acceptance to the older queens. The younger queens came and they don't took over and they're rude, and we don't perform that no more. And it's often the way things are. They have two sets of Miss Gay Roanoke. The original that Tim Clark owns at the park when it first opened, that still goes on. They has that at the Jefferson Center. Then the girl that runs the show direct at the park, she has her Miss Gay Roanoke, but it's the newer kind of Miss Gay Roanoke. So they have that at the park. So we don't go there. We just go to Jefferson Center with Tim Clark. Sets everything else for us to come in and do what we got to do.
So, do y'all not perform anymore, or is there, like, somewhere else that y'all do your drag shows?
Well, every once in a while, Tim Clark would rent the Jefferson Center for the girls to come in and entertain and stuff. They just recently had one. It was January 27th. It was a big turnout. It was 300 people there. But I didn't get to perform because I had problems with my sister with her diabetes, so I didn't show. So in June, they're going to have another big bash at the Jefferson Center he's throwing. So I'm going to go ahead and come out to entertain that. So I do big girl stuff, because actually, there's no need to be out there trying to do a small song when you built like a mountain. Then you've got some girls that just come out, you try to help them, little younger girls. You try to carve that pumpkin, it doesn't work. If you're a basement beast, you're a basement beast. So, just like that. And some of them don't like to be told how to do this and stuff. And a lot of us, back in the day, we know about
hip pads, the firm duty gear that cover. The way a lot of girls don't understand that either. And plus they don't understand about the milk factory situation either. A lot of girls back in the day, we would take and get surgical gloves. And you tie the fingers in the knot, turn the gloves wrong side out, and you fill it up with lotion, and then you tie it up with a rubber band. And then back in the old days, back then, you know, they're moving, you know. And back in the old days, the girls used to take our pantyhose and tie it in a knot and fill it up with bird seeds. Ooh. Yeah.
I'm going to have to try that myself one day. So, I know you said drag has changed over the years. What's that biggest change you've seen? Is it just between, like, personalities between the older queens and the younger queens?
Yeah. I mean, the personalities, I mean, the older girls has always been respectful to the young ones, but the young ones did not like us at all. They don't give you your respect. So, I decided I had performed in different states. That I have been to Florida, I have been to North Carolina, I have been to Savannah, Georgia back in the day. In 94, when I was Miss Veronica Lodge, I traveled a lot, it entertained a lot. But just that Veronica has changed because of all the different cliques. If you don't belong in this clique, you ain't this and that, and it's one big mess. And they always talk about gay pride. I don't go to gay pride because it's you know, it's one, to me, I know about the gayness about gay pride, but it, to me, it's one day of everybody being phony. You got people you ain't seen in 20 years knowing they're going to be two-faced when you met them years ago, they ain't going to change a bit. And you go, well, how you doing, girl? You sure do look good. Mm-hmm. Tell somebody else to care. Because you know they're lying through their teeth. How am I look good and I'm weighing about 300-some pounds? Child, please.
So how would you say that you define your sexuality? Would you lean more towards straight or gay, or are you just more like fluid?
Well, to me, I'm just a big old female impersonator and I'm more gay. I have been in a situation where the female thing and all that madness, and it didn't cut me. I didn't like that at all. I had girls approach me when I was in school that wanted to cut up and throw down, and I'm not all about that. Mm-mm. One girl told me, I could change you. You just let me go to bed with you. And you got my face. So she tricked me. Her parents went home, and I decided to. She called me up to her house, and I got there. She was naked. And I goes in the bedroom, opened the door. She is standing naked. And she come to approach me. I said, don't come there. I said, uh-uh. This parade is not going to march. So she kept coming. So I bought my fist and pushed in the bread basket and rang it. Because, you know, I ain't never heard of madness with what they call it, the clitoris or whatever they call that monster that were around her. I went about that. And back then in high school, the boys used to, oh, I never forget when I was in the ninth grade. And, you know, the me boys knew you was gay. The coach knew you was gay. You had to have PE. You go out on the floor, out on the field to play baseball. And that was a big disaster. They put me over in the center field. The boy knocked up a pop-up. And I had my glove on. Instead of throwing the glove like this for the ball to come and catch it, I held it up like this. And the ball came down, threw the glove, and hit me in the face. I so I took the glove and threw it down and walked back in the locker room. But back then there was so much wildness going on. The boys used to pick. Oh, they used to pick. I know one boy, he didn't like me and I didn't like him. I think I was in the 11th grade. This boy had called, told him in home that I called him some, which I didn't. So I come in, you know how back then everybody held the books up to their chest and switch, and then I came in and he knocked me back out the room across the hall, and I fell. My lunch and everything went everywhere. And he was a bully. So I said, okay, we'll play this. We're going to play it good. So I came out, went up at it, and there was a bunch of steps. Went very wrong. I was at the top steps with my arms folded. So the boy said, get him. So he said, I'm going to get this faggot. So he came up top of the steps, and I met him halfway. And, honey, we battled back. And I picked him up and threw him down the steps. When I got, when before he even got to the bottom of the steps, I was on him. I beat him like a Sunday B-I-T-D-C-H on a Monday morning. And back then, you didn't know you didn't take no mess off them. They wouldn't bother you no more. So you have to do what you have to do. And then the relationships. I learned at an early age. Oh. And I got my fitness shirt when I was 20 years old, and I haven't had a relationship since. I thought he loved me, but he didn't. And we broke up, and he hurt me real bad. We got to fighting in the park, and the same person that got us together was the same one broke us up. So I came up in the park one night, and I told him I was going home. And I guess he thought since I was in Marshall, he going to cut up. So I didn't go home. I got a phone call from a friend from the bar and told me to come down. They were together. Went up in the park, and there they was. She had her lips. He had her lipstick on his cheek. And I walked up to him. I said, well, what's going on? And she can turn around me and laugh. Oh, you think it's funny? I'll show you funny. We got to knocking. I picked up and threw it behind the bar while we was fighting. He would decide to sneak out. The girls had him in a circle. And then when I got through with her, I went out there and was ready to remodel him. And I said, I was good to you and I love you. You're going to play with my fitness like this? And we got to knocking, and I beat him down, of course. And I asked him, who you going to leave tonight with me or her? He put off her spin grapples on me right in front of the park building. And I was truly crushed and cracked and embarrassed and humiliated. But it was something else.
So you had no relationships after that? It was just it
for you? Oh, no, honey. I had a few that wanted to, but I could not be bothered. I don't get bit by the same dog twice. Mm-mm. I learned that at an early age. No, ma'am. I would not jump up that in the trail again. Mm-mm.
So, interesting. Would you ever consider maybe like a few years from now maybe going into relationships again?
Never.
Or it's just not even an option?
Not even an option. Mm-hmm.
So, did you ever think about having children?
Oh, no. My grandmother embarrassed me at our family reunion. I was so embarrassed I could have crawled up underground and threw extra grass on top of it. We had our reunion. My grandmother come up. Now I have four other brothers, and she going to come up in front of all these people, especially ones that knew I was gay. And she haven't seen me in many, many moons. So she comes up. She said, oh, you're a big boy now. You can have me a whole batch of grandbabies. And I lost it. I was very evil. My mama said, go outside and cool off. I was really embarrassed, but they was hooping and laughing. I said, oh, no.
So did most of your family not know that you were gay? Was that they not talked about?
They knew. My father didn't have no understanding. You know, it's always the mother accepts it better than the father. Because, you know, my father knew he was putting stuff up to me to try to make me tough. It didn't work. Like, I have never went hunting. And this man come knocking on the door and told my mother that he wanted to take me hunting. And I said, take me hunting, rabbit hunting. So I got in the truck with the, got in this big field, rabbits jumping all over the field. There I am, a gay down the line. And he gave me the rifle. He said, shoot the rabbit. And oh my God, that was a disaster. I told him I couldn't kill the rabbit because it looked like Buzz Bunny. So he brought me back and told my daddy there was something wrong. But my daddy was something else. He knew, but he accepted it. But, you know, back in his mind, I was always a boy, whatever he called himself doing. I mean, it's just a, ugh. But, ugh. And plus, my daddy's nephew was gay. And he had a lot of gay people on his side, and so did my mother. But he always threw up in your face about my mother's side being gay, but he never did mention his. And his nieces and nephews, they were a trip.
So was that something you ever talked about with, you know, like your cousins and stuff that were gay? Did you all sort of bond together over that?
Oh, we bond real close. I mean, every time I would go to their hometown, we would get together. All the girls would get up under, you know, girls would get up under the tree, start gossiping. My aunt was very accepting. And my aunt had a gay son, and this woman was talking about him to her. Didn't know it was his mama, and they got to knocking. She got a big bowl of potatoes and it throwed in her face and a knock.
Very protective family then.
Oh yes.
So did your family know that you were doing drag when you started to do drag? Did you tell them about it?
I sneaked and did it. The only time I really liked it was, you know, back in the day, when it was Halloween, the only time you got to do it. And my brother asked me always, every Halloween, why I had to dress up like a punk when we got to fighting. And he didn't ask me no more. But my family accepted me well. My father, he didn't know how to he wanted to come across and talk to you about the situation, but he always said something weird, and I'm just annoying. And when he saw me in drag for the first time, he didn't know who I was. He was in a store, and I went past him down the sidewalk, and I was in drag in broad daylight, and he did not even have a clue. And then when my mama first saw me, she was shocked. I decided to go ahead and come out right then and there, and it was a disaster, but I paid it the grapes and went on with my life.
So now that you're older, does your family now know that you do drag?
My mother accepted me well. I mean, before she died, she knew I was a drag queen, and she knew I performed a lot. I even showed her videotapes and everything, and she was proud. I mean, when she was on her deathbed, she had my drag pictures right in her room where all her friends could see it and everything, and she told me she was proud of me and told me that I'd keep doing what I was doing. If I liked it, go ahead and do it. So, you know, my mother said to me, well, my father, he had to accept that at the end. And my mama passed, and I was here in Roanoke, and they called and told me that she was not doing well, so I moved back to Roanoke back to Marsville in 2004, and she passed. And after she passed, my brother, the oldest brother, he was a trip. And after the funeral and everything was over with, a week later, me and my sister were sitting in the house. My daddy told us to come outside. He wanted to talk to us, and he told us that we had to vacate the premises. We didn't have nowhere to go. Lucky our friend had a house for rent, and we moved over in town. And I hated my father, and I still hate him today, because he had another woman on the side. Was very disrespecting. She would come up to the house where my mom was on her deathbed, but he called himself a Christian. And we don't have much to do with our other family members. I don't have nothing to do with my brothers or nothing. I haven't been home. My mama died in 2004, and I haven't been home since.
So you say your dad said that he was a Christian. So did you grow up in a Christian, like, church household?
Yes, I was a Baptist. I chicken got baptized on May the 10th in 79. And I sung in the church choir and all of that. And I just went ahead and just did what I had to do, went up somewhere else and lived.
Did you ever have any, like, difficulties with the church and, like, the drag side of you, like, clashing in any way?
Oh, the church knew. But they didn't, you know, back in the days, a lot of people didn't speak on it. And I had a friend that moved here from Martinsville. She was a real close friend. She passed, so we had to come to Martinsville to her funeral. And her mother was very receptive because her mother knew she was doing drag and they was real close. So half of us went to the funeral in drag and half of us went as boys. So we went, all of us, and all the stuff. And then it was seven girls in drag and seven of us in butch. And we went to her memorial service. They had a great big huge portrait of her in drag on the obituary. On her obituary, she was in full flaming drag, and her name was Michael Missy Martin. And we started coming up in there, and everybody's mouth flew wide open. And the preacher, he was real nice. He got up and said, "You cannot judge." So after the memorial service was over, the queen's mother told us to come over to the house and everything. So we went, and we all had a nice time.
So would you say that the drag queens sort of almost form like their own little, like the older drag queens form like their little family here in Roanoke?
Well, most of us don't, you know, we stay in touch, but as far as visiting, back in the day we used to visit people, you know, everybody go to everybody's house, and we don't do that no more. We talk on the phone. I got to talk to a few before I was going visiting. I don't visit, I don't go to gay functions, no. Just, I don't know, I haven't did drag since, I did drag 2 years ago, and I have been out of circulation since 2004. And it was not cute because drag constantly changes, and when you haven't did it in a long time, you're trying to get back into it, it doesn't work, because I had got into it, the makeup was horrible, the hair was horrible. Haven't worn my shoes in many years, so you're trying to squeeze an elephant in a mouse hole, because when you're uncomfortable and you got on heels, you're uncomfortable all over. So I came out and I did Jennifer Holliday, and everything was cute, and then got on stage. Feet started hurting, honey. When your feet started hurting, you were uncomfortable. So, and it, I mean, it was real painful. And I'm saying that, and tears flowing. They thought I was doing that. I was into the summer. I was in pain. So when I came off stage, honey, I told them, this is enough. They said, well, why? I said, because my feet was hurting, and then I didn't go in the second half. I told them, this is, I'm through with this situation. No, no, no.
So have you noticed, like, a big change in the way that, like, drag makeup and drag, like, dress has been over the years?
Drag constantly changes. I got a daughter that lives in, a gay daughter that lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and she makes her own wigs and stuff. And I went to Atlanta to a pageant up there. It was a Miss Black Universe. I'd never been to Atlanta before in my life, and they had a drag pageant, and the hair was out of this world. This one guy had took three Donna Ross wigs and sewed them together, and the hair was out like this. And I was amazed, because now the hair is bigger. I mean, they can take two or three wigs and sew them together, but after you take and style it, it looks good. It looks rough when they're doing it, but after, you know, tame out, it looks flawless. And it changes a lot, because you have to have your hip pads on, and but it's changed a lot. The makeup has changed, because back then a lot of girls did. I have, you know, I went to Raleigh to a club down there, and I have heard about camp drag, but I never saw it. So we went to Raleigh, North Carolina, to a club called Legends, and my friend says, we got a queen down here, her name is Perina Child, and she does camp drag. What kind? Because I never heard of camp drag before. So we get down there, and we're all in the motel room, so her room is down the hall from us. So she told us, she called the room and said, when we get through, when our makeup's up, come down there and see her. So goes down, knock on the door, and she's, the big mirror is like this, so you don't see her face. All you do is hear the music blowing, and she's ducked down behind and just painting. And all of a sudden she stopped. And my friend knew about it, but I didn't. So when she did come up out of it, oh, I was cracked. I mean, she had all these fluorescent colors cleaned up the hair, and it was all black and pink and had designs in her face. It was, she had on these great big, she had took some foam and made these great big hips with a big old huge smock, heels this tall. nails out to here, and I was just through. And when she came up to me, she says, and her drag name was Purina Child, and I was through with that too. But she got up in the club and she took and gave them a tour. They liked it, her. But, you know, the name of doing drag and stuff, doing shows, you always got to have a gimmick. The funniest thing I ever seen done in drag history was a queen came here from Greensboro, North Carolina. Her name was Neela O'Hara, Big Black Queen. So she came in with all these costumes, and then she had made a big, huge corn head and put lashes on it and had it painted just as nice. And so when it got her turn to come out and hit the stage, they start playing the Twilight Zone, and the music started bumping, and all of a sudden it came to a complete stop. And then it went into Charlene, Got to Be Real, and the music was just bumping, and the children were sitting in the floor near the stage. And honey, when it hit that beat, all of a sudden it went, something went bing, and then the drum beat came in. And when she stepped through that curtain, they were scooting across the floor backwards on their tails. I guess it shocked them, because Neela always had a gimmick. And she came out and did Got to Be Real and had this great big corn head with big huge earrings. Her face was painted. It was cute.
So what would you say that your gimmick or your shows were based on?
Well, mostly I does music that match my build. I do Aretha Franklin, Jennifer Holliday. I do something that's going to match my build. Because it ain't no need to going out there looking like a bird and trying to be a Tweety Bird. That don't work.
So have you found that the way that younger drag queens perform now is vastly different from the way older drag queens
good
perform?
Good Lord. They be doing acrobats and stuff on stage, flipping like monkeys. And I mean, it constantly changed, but some girls, I guess they think it's funny, but I think it's embarrassing. I remember one queen that came out and was doing a slow number, and she took her breast, the rubber breast out and touched up her face with it. I have a daughter, her name is Christina Kelly, and she came out on stage, and she's a big girl too. And she was up there doing a number, so this person decided to embarrass her on stage. She's up there doing a slow number, and you can guess what they tipped her with? A loaf of bread and a pack of bologna. And you know what she did? Grabbed the chair, sat on stage, and made sandwiches and ate her number. She plucked them right back. And then there was one queen, her name was Jon Snow. She was a big girl, and this skinny queen did not like her because she was big. And she was up there doing her number, and the queen has tipped her with a can of Slim Fast on stage. And she said, Miss Grace, she says, you know, you can't be nice to nobody. I said, do what you have to do. So after the show was over, she took Slim Fast with her child on its shoulder and pulled it on the head. And she says, I'm not through with that yet. She said, that B.I.T. worked me. She says, I'm going to get her. So guess what she did? She made up with the queen, ended up being her best friend. This queen has been doing drag for many, many years, have built up her whole costumes flawless. So they decided to be real best friends. So the queen moved her in with her. And so one day the queen had to go to work, and she told the queen that she was sick. So the queen took and went to work. She took every stitch of drag. I mean, it was real expensive drag. Put it in garbage bags and set it on the corner for the garbage man to pick up.
Long term.
Oh, back in the day, I mean,
on that one.
You'd just be shocked at how vicious people can be. Oh, yes, honey. I remember one queen came out, and the queen didn't like her, and she put Vaseline on her shoes. And Miss Thing would love to huck her, but she loved to dance fast, and that night she went into a spin and went flying through there. When she landed, it was not a cute situation. People can be extra, extra shady.
With like the shadiness and, you know, the getting back at each other and everything, did you ever have issues with the police in Roanoke and downtown?
Many issues with them. Oh, yes, man, this queen had got to fighting, and I went to jail. And then one night I was on the corner of Salem Avenue with snow, real, real deep. And this queen rode by and called me a bountiful snow beast. And we were living together, and she called me that in the snow. So she was strung out on crack. I said, I know exactly how I'm going to get her. And I got her good, too. She was in her room doing crack, and I said the door was cracked. And I said, I'm going to wait till she get down to her last piece of crack. And when she went to blow out the smoke, I blew in the door and whooped her, you know what. So we had to go downtown. We were in front of the Judge Harris. He was the only black judge they had in Roanoke, and we had to go to court. It was embarrassing. And the judge asked me what happened, and I told him. He said, Mr. Kelly, what did you say? I said, I was on Salem doing the snow, and she rode by and called me a bundle of snow beast. And the people in the courtroom laid in the floor, hooping and laughing. So she decided to come to court in drag. I guess she's trying to impress. What's it? He says, where is Mr. Preston? I said, oh, it's out there in the hall. So she comes up in drag, and he says, Mr. Preston, why are you looking like this? He says, you don't come in my courtroom looking like that. I said, oh, she's 100% real. So she says something. He said, look at Mr. Kelly. He said, Mr. Kelly's a big man. He said, Mr. Kelly could do some serious damage to you. He said, Mr. Kelly, I got a question to ask you. Do you play football? And I said, I have. And he says, Mr. Kelly could really hurt you. And the case was dismissed. Because back in the day, you know, you're always going to have people that run by and throw stuff at you and pick at you. And sometimes you just get tired. So one night I was out on Saturday Avenue, and a bunch of redneck boys rode by, and they, you know how you could have a can of beer in the weather without being open. They throwed it and they hit me in the back with it, and they called me a faggot. So I did what I had to do. They came up there and came back around. Well, when they came back around, there was a car in front of them and a car behind them. So they couldn't go nowhere. So I was behind this building, and I got a big, huge cinder block. And honey, I came around that corner and stepped out this in the block, threw it over my head. I had threw it so hard that the windshield fell in their lap. And I had to go to court for that too. The judge asked me, he said, what happened? I told him what happened. He said, well, Mr. Kelly, you had to protect yourself. He said, they was wrong for doing that to you. They didn't know you. They had no business doing it. And he said, I'm sure they learned a good lesson after that. I mean, the younger crowd has came in and they're rude and they're nasty, and they done got to the point now that they don't want no acceptance to the drag, the older drag queens, and which is a big mess. We got one queen that she performs every Friday night at the park. She's 10 times bigger than me, and she thinks she's a star. So I had to put her in her place. I said, you sitting up here thinking, granted, you're not all that, honey. I said, that's why we call you Cowzilla.
So, I don't know if you, a lot of the younger drag queens, they do a lot of, like, music now. Is that something that, like, the older drag queens did, or is that more of, like, a new age thing, all the different music?
And everybody has a different kind. You got one queen, and I think she's part camp, because her make the... I mean, she would dress up in combat boots, and she would wear combat boots with white socks, and then she would have on a wedding gown, and it's big, too little, it's busted down the back, and she used to get these big black shoestrings and put toes in it and tie it up in a knot, and they had the audacity to crown her Miss Spark. And I had no understanding. I was really, really was through. And then, last year, they crowned her Miss Gay Roanoke at Large. Miss Gay Roanoke, not Miss Roanoke at Large. They crowned her Miss Gay Roanoke. And the girls were not happy. I mean, she doesn't take drag serious like the rest of us do. I mean, she's just a mess. And you try to help her, but she's the kind that you can't tell her nothing. and it's, oh, every time I see her, I turn my head, because it's, she's just a disgrace. Because the Tim Clark, the owner, Miss Gay Runner, he must have took it as a joke, because before her, he had a pageant out here to the Tanglewood Mall, Holiday Inn out there. He had a pageant out there, Miss Gay Runner, and he crowned himself as Miss Gay Runner. And he didn't do drag. He started doing drag, and he looked horrible. And each year it gets worse and worse. I mean, they had something that had been in generation for many, many years, and they did not make it serious like it's been over the years, you know. And it more like a joke to them, but it's part of history. You don't make a joke out of history. And so they asked me to come down to perform for Miss Ronica Lodge, and I didn't go. I supposed to have performed last year at the Jefferson Center with them. I sent a promo picture of me, but I didn't show up. And it's a trip. I mean, drag. I mean, you can go anywhere. I mean, I've been upstate. I've been this way. It's nothing like Roanoke. I mean, Roanoke, you got these different cliques. And if you don't fit in them, you know, they make you very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. Everybody got their own different cliques. You got the ones that's grand and lovely. You got the ones that's preppy. And you got so many groups.
So do you think Roanoke has really changed since you first moved here?
It has really, really changed. I mean, back then when drag was fun and everything, but the younger generation has came in and they just done took it to a whole different kind of level, and it's not fun anymore. It's a mess. You go to the park some nights and you'd be shocked what you see.
Is it surprising to you that there's not as many like gay bars and things in downtown Roanoke?
Yes. I mean, I guess it changes over the years. I mean, we have one bar that was in Bluefield, West Virginia, that's been open for 40-some years, and they closed about 10 years ago in Shamrock. Then we used to go to a club in Greensboro called Warehouse. It has been open for, I think, 34 or 43 years. It closed down. And, I mean, places that you really felt comfortable doing shows and stuff, and everything changes. It really does. But we do need another bar.
Now, I know you said you moved here in 77. So, did you ever have any experience knowing anyone during, like, the AIDS crisis around then? Like, any friends or anything that were affected by that?
Yes. I had a friend that passed. He was one of the first... I'm not the first gay person to pass, but the first gay person to pass that I knew. And he was real nice. I mean, he treated you well, and he was very accepting, and everybody was close to him. We went to his funeral and everything. And the AIDS benefits has changed over the years. I mean, everybody wants to be a star. I mean, you're there for a cause. But don't turn into a sideshow or a circus. That's not the point of stuff. You've never seen none of the old girls come in and perform at the AIDS benefits because they don't want them there. You got the younger crowd that comes in and they're doing monkey flips, and it's just a big mess. I didn't go to them. I think my last AIDS benefit at the park was in 94.
Do you think that crisis and, like, that outbreak here in Roanoke sort of changed the way that, like, the drag scene and, like, the gay scene was? Did it make it a little more, like, closed in, want to be safer?
Well, I talk to a lot of people about being safe. I mean, because these days you never know what you're getting into. I was with a person two years ago, and it was something strange about the situation, and I picked up on, thank God I did. What was it? We had went out, and come time to do what you had to do. he was insistent that I use his condom. And I kept wondering why he kept insisting. That's why I have some right over here. He said, no, just use this one. So when he went to take his clothes off, I switched condoms on him. Thank God I did. Because he had punched 5 holes in it through the pack. He sure had. And after he left, I took and tore it off, went in there, ran the water in it, and had 5 holes in it. Because when you unwrap a condom, and when it's in the back, the tip is right in the middle. And all that you got to do is punch it a couple of times. And that's why I told the girls, if you're going out on a date with somebody, may use your own condoms. You got some people that's extra, extra eager when it comes to safetiness and stuff. I got one friend. I sat and I talked to them for 2 hours. I told him, honey, it's not fun like you think it is. I said, it's a dangerous world out there. You have to be on your J-O-B 24/7 on alert of what's going on. Talked to them for 2 whole hours. She gonna try to educate me. You know what she told me to my face? Well, I ain't got to worry about that because that 80s stuff is in y'all's generation. That's exactly what she said out of her face. And she said, furthermore, my boyfriend has a low sperm count. Okay. She thought she couldn't get it because he had a low sperm count and she was barebacking him. And about a month later, she came to me and sat down and talked to me. She said, Miss Grace, she says, I don't understand why I did that. But see, a lot of young people don't like to listen to the older crowd, people, the older people. I don't understand that. An older person can tell you things that you need to know. A young person can't tell you nothing because they just out there. And you know, you talk about the people with about safety, and it goes in one ear and come out the other. I had one friend, her T count was 0. And I told her, I said, I'm going to tell you this. One of the doctors, I'm not going to say which one, told her something, and her T-cell count was 0. I got with her, took her to my doctor, and she got back on the meds, and her T-cell count is almost non-detectable. Because I sit down and talk to people about it because in some cases, a person that's HIV cannot talk to a stranger about it because they don't know what's up, but they can talk more comfortable to a person that's in the same situation. They're more at ease with it, they can talk. But a lot of people just don't want to hear, they just don't listen. I like being safe. But in the younger years, you didn't know about, back in the 70s, there was no such thing. So a lot of people didn't use condoms back in them days. I've been HIV since 85. And I do my meds, I stay up on my meds and everything, and I'm down to non-detectable. Because I listen. Because when they first told me at the health department, I had prepared myself. I think if I hadn't prepared myself, I think it would have been a disaster for me. But I had prepared myself in years advance. So when I went and checked, me and this friend of mine went in the health department at the same time. She went in one room, I went in the other. When they told her, I heard her hit the floor. I heard her scream and holler. But when they talked to me, they said, Michael, we had to tell you this. It didn't faze me. I knew what I had to do. So what I took and did was I got material on it, and I studied this and studied that, and I got a friend that helped me get with the situation to get my HIV doctor. But you know, it's shocking because really I did not know what it was. I was having night sweats and my whole bed would be soaked, and I didn't understand why. But when they told me, I did all my literature on it. I got with this friend of mine. She told me a lot about it, and thank God that she did, because I had to do what I had to do. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people think it was embarrassing to go to the health department and all this. To me, it wasn't. That was my life. And you don't play with your life. So I went, and I'm glad I did. That's why I'm here today.
Do you think that's still a problem today? Is that, like, fear of, like, embarrassment prevents people from
coming? I like to say, when, you know, some people, they're coming and I educate them about things they should know. If you go get tested, do what you have to do. Go get tested, and once you get tested, get into the literature and read about it, and then go find you a specialist, that's a doctor that's good for that. But they have a few doctors here that's not, how can I put this? They're not helpful at all. They're supposed to be helpful for you, but they're not. I had one doctor. I went in her office, and I came in and I sat down, and she was very snobbish. When I first met her, she had a nasty attitude. And I told her, I said, look, I don't like your attitude. Do you know how you got it? Before I can answer, you probably don't know. Excuse me, I think you're very rude and very, let me get you straight right here. I don't need that. It's other people that will help me. I had one doctor, I can't say the name, that gave me wrong medication. Took me off my medicine for almost a year. And then I knew something went right. So I got with this other doctor. The other doctor educated me well about it. She told me, she said, she took and got me, got on the computer. She looked at the meds I was taking. All of them had red dots up beside them. And she said, you know what these red dots are, Michael? I said, no. These red dots are indicating your medicine's not doing nothing for you. And I got with her, and everything's nice, and that's why I'm non-detectable. This woman had me on medicine that I didn't even need. But yet you end up practicing your field, and you're not doing it right.
So do you think that, I mean, I know back in like the 70s and 80s, there wasn't a lot of awareness about AIDS and HIV and stuff like that. Do you think that that's still a problem now? There's not enough information being talked about, and the community's not really pushing, like, this is a problem, this is something you need to be aware of?
To some extent, yes. But a lot of people just don't take it seriously. Because they're on this kick about, it can't happen to me. But until you in those that person's shoes, you learn. I mean, I used to support AIDS benefits, but I figure like this, if you're doing an AIDS benefit, and the people are there to collect the money for that, I think it's wrong if you go ahead and collect the money, get them the check in their hand on stage so you know where it's going. Because you don't know where it's going to. I mean, you're going out of your way to do the AIDS benefit, and then when it comes to the end of the night with the money, the persons are there. Why don't you give them the money right then and there in front of people? They didn't. They had a group back in the day called Sisters in the Name of Love, and they were treacherous, very treacherous. They would call themselves helping people with AIDS, but they were really spending money on themselves. We did a big AIDS benefit down at the Patrick Henry one year, and we raised terrible money. This girl had a son, a brother that was sick. She asked them for help. She didn't get it. She had to go out and get the stuff that she needed for herself. But the ones that called themselves helping people, they was wearing new gowns for shows and stuff, and you knew what the money was going to. It's, you know, people just, I don't understand them. Because you get with people, like I have been with, I've seen a lot of friends of mine past. I have been by their side. I've been there for their support. But other friends that claim they're so close to them. I had a friend, now let me tell you how vicious people can be. I had a friend that knew that I was sick. She came in here from California, and I was out on the corner when I was sitting down with a friend because we just come out the club, and we're sitting there talking. She walks to me. You know what she said to me, to my face? She said, girl, I heard you had the virus, girl. Well, it's like this, girl. May I sing at your funeral? Right? Out of the blue. And you know what I told her? You might sing around, but don't let me yodel at yours first. I mean, she was that kind of rude. Like, she had a friend, I had a friend that was gay, that was sick, and you could see the high-headed. She would take that person, pick them up, and take them to different people's houses and go in the other room and make fun of them. That's how bad people can be. That child came to me crying. I said, "It's all right." And I told her, "You have your fun now." I said, "But lately, I bet you I'd be walking behind you." See, we have gay families. Like, we have gay sons, gay daughters. Like, my gay son had passed away. She come upstate, come to the funeral. They were doing his funeral, and each person was supposed to get up and say a reflection on the person that had passed. She gets up and makes it all about herself. Oh, she come in with this big dashiki on, a little African cap, and she make, "Oh, I was HIV, and God did this for me," and all that. And a couple weeks later, she passed. You can do stuff like that. I mean, people can be very, very, very vicious. I've been in the situation where I've been around friends I've been knowing my whole life since I've been here. And as soon as they found out I was sick, they could not be bothered. I mean, that hurts. But you know, I'm a strong person, so I went home. Because like I say, I'm doing fine. What about them? Some of them ain't even here. But it just, ugh. It's just amazing how vicious and nasty people can be. And I learned that during my many years about AIDS and all that. And people can be very nasty. It's just a mess.
Were there any groups that, other than the one you mentioned before, were there any groups that were sort of like for helping people with AIDS and HIV and spreading that awareness? Were you involved with any of those groups?
I was in some of the groups, okay? They had Counselor Community Service. They had another group that they would come up and pick you up, and everybody would go to it and have the meeting. But it was one thing they didn't do like that. I mean, one thing I didn't like about it, they would pick you up in this van. There were people that come there that was not HIV. They just came to see who had it and go back and repeat it. That should have never happened.
So was it almost in a way similar to like Alcohol Anonymous is, where it's like you're not supposed to say names and things? It's more of like a...
Yeah, it was a private thing.
Yeah.
And then you had people that were sick, and see where you're sick, to go out and spread in the street what you had. Like, I had a friend one night, and I know she was acting strange towards me, and I said, "Why are you acting strange?" She said, "Well, I heard something." "Well, what did you hear?" "Well, I heard that you were sick." "Okay, yes, I am." And I said, and I told them about it, and I said, "Have you went and got checked?" I said, "Back in the day, you was wild, too." Never did. And then one said they didn't want to know, and them the ones that had passed on. But it's just something else. I mean, I have a lot of close friends that have went on before me, and I mean a lot, because every time you turn around, you're going to funerals. And one child blue just came out night and asked me, they said, "Miss Grace, you go to all these friends' funerals that died of AIDS and stuff. How do you feel?" I said, "What do you mean, how do I feel?" She said, "How do you feel about going to funerals thinking, you know, one of these days that's going to be you?" I said, "I'm a strong person." I said, "Because when I go up to visit, to view that person's body, I said, I reverse it on myself, because I knew one of these days my day going to come. I'm prepared for all that." I said, "It makes me stronger. It does not make me weak. It makes me stronger."
Do you think that during that time, the amount of people that were being lost, do you think that really shook the gay community and the drag community and sort of almost made them, did they grow closer at all? Or did the stigma almost...
Well, the older crowd got closer together. Like, when we started doing AIDS benefits at the park, we was there for support. We did our drags numbers, and we, you know, everything was fine. Everybody pulled together. I mean, but this younger generation, they have no respect because it can't happen to them.
Do you think that that stigma of, like, you know, you have the virus and things like that, do you think that that's still true today, or is it less today? That almost, like, fear that, like, if you touch someone's hand, you're going to catch the virus type of thing.
Oh, yeah, you're always going to have people like that. There's always ignorance, you know. I mean, some people just downright rude.
So I know with a lot of times with drag, I know you said that your friends were men. When you were first introduced, there were men who came and they dressed as women. You were sort of like, oh, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that they, like, the majority of the people you knew identified as gay men who just dressed as women?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it more they identified as transvestites or transgender?
Yeah, transvestites.
So what would you say that you identified as?
I identify myself as a female illusionist. Uh-huh.
So do you feel like today there's a lot of almost like controversy with the way that drag is, the distinction between men who dress as women and then men who want to be women?
You got a lot that you got a lot of friends that work. We see we call ourselves drag queens and we call the butch boys bunnies. And a lot of boys wanted to try but never did. I had one friend that we were been close for many, many years, and he always wanted to do it, but he just didn't act on it. So one Halloween night, he says, I need you to do something for me. I said, what is that? He said, we got to go shopping. So he went and got all the drag, bought all the drag stuff, beat his face, and he looked it lovely. I mean, he was shocked at what he looked in drag, and he was just happy as hell. Happy as a pumpkin boy's town, as they say in the old days. And he liked it. And he does support drag real well. I mean, every show they have, he was there. And he liked it a lot, but it was just on a Halloween thing. But I think he wanted to explore it more, but his pride wouldn't let him. There are a lot of people that wants to. They can't. Just like, you know, you always going to have people to criticize you when you're in drag. Okay, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, a club called Matthews. I was not told that it was all black. I didn't know that it was almost all black until I got there. And I said, this is not going to be cute. So me, I decided to change up a little. I said, well, okay, I made a big ruffle coat, great big huge ruffle coat, made the gown to match, and I had ordered a Donna Ross Linus wig. And I said, and the child said, I said, of course. I might not look like Donna Ross, I might be Dinosaur Ross, but I'm going to do her. So I came out on stage, and the music was, Ain't No Mountain High Enough was booming. So I'm sitting backstage as the music playing, I'm getting psyched up to hit the stage. Got psyched up, honey. The music started booming, and I hit the stage, busted through the curtain. People's mouths flew wide open. I came up on this table. There was about table on this side, table across the table. Hey, oh, you know. So I came on down and got in the middle of the floor and performed, and I went ahead and went towards where they were sitting there and was doing Ain't No Mountain Enough, and you cannot believe what somebody hollered. Look at Donna Ross. She done ate the Supremes. I was cracked, but I went out. So I said, oh, we're going to play this like this. So I said, okay, my second number. I said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and let them know the big girls can do whatever they want. So I had they got the song by Jennifer Holliday called No Frills Love, and it's fast. So I put on a straighted fringe outfit, boots, I made a wig to come to my shoulders, and I came back out, and I twirled the house down. You talking about shaking up some chicken grease? I shook it up that night, honey. a huckabuck back. I got right there in front of where all them was, and I had did the dance where you do a kick and you kick back, and I went into a spin and came out with a split. They were through. I said, this is what's happened when you're a big girl. We could twirl too. But, you know, it's always going to be somebody that's going to criticize you on stage. But I learned, when it comes to pageantry, if you don't have yourself together, you will be the basement of the ball, huh? The basement beast of the ball. I learned that lesson hard. The first time I ran for Miss Ronica Lodge, my first year, it was a big disaster because the girls that I had was helping me with this. They, half of them was on crack, half of them was drunk. So the day of the pageant, they supposed to help me. They'd been out all night partying. I had to sew my gown on hand. My updo was a mess because I had a big basketball face. They had snatched my hair back with a little tiny ball right here on top of my head. So I looked like a dog tan jar top of a cookie jar. And it was awful. My gown was handmade. It was just one disaster. But I wasn't getting pressed down. But I did get first one up. It was six contestants that got first one up. But I saw my mistakes, and I learned from my mistakes. So when I ran in 1994, I came for them. Oh, I was very clever, honey. I took about all the old stuff that I had used years before and hung it up in the dressing room. And they had a little group of queens to make fun of you. And they sat and seen what I was throwing up on the rack. But I have remembered in this game, there's always a person that you don't suspect of being close to. When Big Neely O'Hara from Greensboro, North Carolina, Neely is 7'1" feet tall, and Neely was about 250 pounds, big girl. Didn't nobody speak to her or nothing. I came up to her and I carried on a conversation where we ended up being best friends. When she found out I was running for Miss Ronica Lodge, she says, come to Greensboro, I got something for you. She gave me the gowns to wear. She gave me, put together my talent and stuff. And that night of the pageant, I was ready. Well, I came for them. They thought I could be the same old country cow I was. So when it came to talent, my talent was flawless. I got a standing ovation. When it came to creative fashion, sportswear, I was only because I went to Added Dimensions out here at Valley View and got my little outfit. But honey, when it came to evening gown, they were shocked. Because I had a friend that took 2 weeks and put them on top of each other with freakish curls in it. And I won talent. I won best in evening gown. And when they crowned me, I said, The same ones that picked, but the same ones got the face cracked. And the same ones, when I came to the stage and I took my crown out, sit on the table to pack my stuff up to leave, here they come. Well, girl, you shocked us, really? Oh, now I'm tell you, weren't shocked. Oh, but we was. Good. You got a lot to come later on. But those were the days. I learned a lot through drag history. I learned about AIDS. I learned about a whole lot of education on myself and things, and I'm doing fine now. You know, I got neighbors over there, and where I live at, a lot of them don't care for drag. I don't do drag at home. If I have a show, I would take my costumes out, but I come out as a boy. When I come back home, I come as a boy. For the name of the game is respect, and you have to learn to respect where you live. If you ain't got no respect where you live, that's what's gonna cause a problem. You got other people that want to carry on like that. Like I was sitting at my house a couple of months ago. Here come two drag queens to my house in broad daylight. And I noticed that I heard, because one of them called and said, where you live? And I gave them directions. I didn't know that we're in drag. And believe me, the neighbors came out and they knocked on my door. I said, y'all come on in. I said, you knew better to come here like that. The dragon is a place and time for everything. I said, you don't do that. Well, we thought you can't pass. looked like one woman, Queen's rough. I mean real rough. We call her Fleeta Flintstone because she looks like Fred Flintstone's mama.
So I know you had mentioned when you were getting help with your first pageant that people were drinking and doing drugs and things. Did Roanoke have a big drug scene? Was that a problem? Or
Back in the old days, it was more like drinking. I mean, as far as pot, it wasn't that much around. It was around, but I guess people didn't pay no mind. Most of the day, like they did, was drink.
So, what would be your biggest takeaway from doing drag? What was the biggest, like, life lesson that you learned doing it?
A lesson I learned from it? I learned a lot. I mean, I always wanted to get a crown. I always wanted to get trophies to prove the, what I have done, what I have done, and how my career went with me doing drag. And it makes me proud to sit there and you can look up on your shelf and there's a crown, that's your drag picture, and you accomplished all that. A lot of people couldn't do it because I was scared to death. But when they told me about doing it, I was through. Because I had seen them do it, but I just didn't think I would do it. But I got the nerve to do it, and I'm glad that's over with.
Did you ever notice a lot of other people of color doing drag in Roanoke? Was that a thing, or was it more Caucasians doing drag?
Well, back in the day, it was more, it was a lot of white queens doing drag. It was, and then it started being where it was a, it got into being a lot of black stuff. But the most amazing thing I have learned in my drag career is I have always wanted to see a whole black pageant. And up in Atlanta, they have all that. They have Miss Black Universe. They have Miss Black America. They have Miss Black USA. And it's so nice to see that. I mean, you'd be shocked at what you see in those kind of pageants because a lot of people, they do old school. And they had the boy pageants too. They had a group of boys that come out dressed like the Jackson 5 and they had the big afros and the outfits was good. And they was doing a routine that was cute. They had one queen come out and she was doing Denise Williams' song called Black Butterfly. And she come out doing them and all of a sudden here comes this great big guy dressed up in a butterfly outfit. Real masculine looking. And when she got down near the song, the boy turned to the artist and took his mess off. And you talking about something that was fierce? He was, I can't say the words I want to express, but he was drop dead kick yourself in the balls gorgeous. He was a lovely chunk of Charconi.
So do you think that in Roanoke there was a lot of diversity within the gay community?
Yep.
And do you think that's continued today, that there's still a lot of like diversity, and or has almost like that click like culture that you've talked about, do you think that that's influenced how diverse the community has been?
Yeah, I mean, okay, you got a show director, her name is Inga Satter, she's at the park, and she doesn't like to see a, she's a big girl herself, but she don't like to see a big girl come in and upstage her. And when she was Miss Veronica Lodge, she thought she had the world on her, but honey, this other queen came in from Greensboro, knocked her out the box. And she's threatened by another big girl that performs. She doesn't dance. She glides across the floor like the Frosty the Snowman, the Bonobo Snow Monster, that's what we call her. And she's the one that really stopped most of all this old girl. She was part of them that, that kept us not coming to the park, not doing show, because she was show director.
So do you think that Roanoke today is accepting?
I think back in in the old days, it was a lot of diversity about, a lot of people didn't like drag queens, fag this and fag that. But it's a lot of acceptance, and it's changed over the years.
Do you wish that there were more venues for drag shows and things like that to be happening again, like old school shows in Roanoke?
That's what I like about they have it at the Jefferson Center, because it's more for us, the old drag community. And the old drag community brings out the older crowd. Down at the park, you got teenagers. They serve alcohol. But they're not making no money. They can't drink. So they're messing up their sales. Because older people likes to drink, and they're going to support the bar. They don't support the bar, because they're not making money like they're supposed to, because they're teenagers. See, they figure they cater to the younger crowd, you get more money. It doesn't work that way. Now, okay, it's like this. At the park, they would bring in female impersonators from RuPaul's Drag Race, and they bring those people in. But look how much money you're spending. You're spending thousands of dollars to get them here when you got perfect talent here. They have bought in a lot of RuPaul Drag Race people. They even have bought in Lady Bunny. Lady Bunny is the one that discovered RuPaul. She's been here several times.
Mm-hmm. Has RuPaul ever been here?
No, they said she has the nastiest attitude you ever want to see. Mm-hmm. So, Charlottesville wanted to bring RuPaul to a club 216 in Charlottesville. And when they talked to her, she was kind of snobbish to them. So they said, well, we'll work you. They bought in Lady Bunny and that created RuPaul.
So do you think that, like, the queens that are on, like, RuPaul's drag show, those are the types of queens that are sort of changing how it is now and making it more of, like, a competition type of thing?
Yeah, just
as
like
opposed to, like, a...
They have a queen that lives here from Roanoke that was on RuPaul's Drag Race. And when she got back, she got famous, and it went to her head. She did not acknowledge that she was from Virginia. And she's a very talented queen. Now, she has did drag. She started drag when she was 14 years old. She sews, and one of the best performers you ever met in your life. She went on to work for this other drag queen that makes beauty gowns. Her name is Coco Vega. She's in Las Vegas now performing. So she'd have made it up in the big top. But like I say, you never forget where you come from.
So do you think that there's a disconnect between, like, the younger teenage gay community and the older community? Is there a reason, do you think, that there's such a big disconnect?
It's mainly because the younger crowd, they don't know about the history. They just out there doing drag. They're going out by what they hear. But they're the type that don't want you to tell them anything. I mean, like I say, if a person needs help, I'll go and help them. But when you go up to a person, you try to be polite and help them, they turn around with a little smart answer like, I got this, I don't need your help. Okay, all right. And then when you don't win tonight, like they do tonight, and you don't win, you get your face cracked. And then I said, well, what happened, girl? She said, what? I said, you didn't win. Your head was up in the clouds. What happened? She says, I think I made several mistakes. I said, no, you know everything.
So do you think a project like this is good to help sort of bridge that gap between the younger and older generations to get those stories out there?
It will, because it would educate the young ones that don't know better, which need to be known better. I mean, it's just that the younger crowd just doesn't destroy it. Drag history that they really have. Like years ago, you got paid for doing shows at the park. We don't get paid at the park, because why should you pay us older girls when you got the young ones doing it for free?
That's on me. I totally had a question and then it like went out of my head because I was listening. So do you think that in Roanoke there's enough knowledge about like the queer, trans, drag, like black community? Or is that, do you still think that that's almost like a taboo subject that people don't talk about?
A lot of them don't talk about it. I mean, that's why me and Carlin, you know, me and Carlin have been friends for many, many years, and we talk about the old days, you know. I mean, I was at my house and I was going through some pictures, and I had ran across a picture that we show we had did at the horse club. I took a picture of way back when, and I get called her over and gave her several pictures of what she used to do shows at the horse club. Because Carlin Wilson was the very first drag queen that they put in the Roanoke magazine. And see, back then, I mean, you don't see no other drag queens in there, but back in the day, she was a fabulous entertainer. Still is today. She still does drag. She was at the Jefferson Center last month, the 27th last month she performed. And, I mean, a lot of people change over the years. She doesn't. I mean, she's got the same body, the same look. And, you know, some people change with over the years, and some people don't.
So do you think that over time, like, say from, like, the 70s to now, 2018, that the black community has become a little more accepting of the gay community, the trans community, and stuff like that?
They have, but the main thing is they need to learn how to respect people. If you're going up in a public place and you're going through that switch and then flaming and acting like a fool, you're going to get a response. But if you carry yourself as a gay person and just go, you know, just, you know, you can tell a person is gay. You don't have to show it. But you got these young crowds, oh, that goes to the malls and drag and stuff, and you know, just, you know, we didn't do stuff like that. A lot of the younger people like to push the issues.
So do you feel like that's where a lot of like the disconnect is between like the older and younger generation, where the younger generation is more focused on being more in your face and putting the issues and like,
yes,
almost like branding themselves as like,
yes,
this is what I am.
Yes.
So the, you would say like the older generation, they don't focus as much on like labeling themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I like gay pride and everything, but it's a place and time for everything. When you got gay pride going on, you got the churches right downtown in Edward Park, and you right downtown and people coming out to church, they don't need to see that. Because when they first started having gay pride over here in the Harlem Park, it was a nice place to have it at. When they had that, well, I seen it was nice. But you got other, you know, when people come out, you got the great crowd that overdoes it, that flames and flies all around the sidewalks, hollering and stuff. You don't have to do that. You don't. We used to do drag shows at gay pride when we was at Harlem Park, which was nice, but over the years everything changes.
Do you think that the black church has become more accepting?
Some has, but you know, a lot of people stuck in their old ways. They'll never change. But you got some that will accept you and some won't.
And I know there's always that talk of, like, you know, the choir directors are usually, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always, like, choir members, and, like, you can always tell. Do you think that that's, like, the fact that we don't talk about it as the black community, is that one of the reasons why you see, like, the lack of diversity within not only the gay community, but, like, the drag community as mm-hmm. well? Because there's not that freedom to express how you feel?
Mm-hmm.
And is that something that you ever felt like you struggled with?
Yeah. I mean, when they wanted to have meetings at the park and stuff, and they talk about this, they talk about that, but the young crowd is still not coming across, and they never ever will. Never ever will.
So do you think that maybe by getting all these different stories out, getting these, you know, people of color stories out for people to hear, will start making that gap a little smaller, sort of bring the generations back together?
Mm-hmm. Because, see, back in the day around when the horoscope days, you had, I mean, it was a beautiful club, and you had straights and gays going there, and everybody got along. I mean, you never heard no fighting at the horoscope. You never heard nothing like that. That's the whole community that's grouped in together, and everything was fine. The park was the same way later on.
So is there anything that you would say to maybe like a newer drag queen coming in? Would any like specific like advice that you would give someone coming into the scene?
Well, I gave several of them. You know, my daughter Christina Kelly. When I first met her, I met her when she was 16 or 17. And I was in the park when I didn't drag. And I noticed every time I would come in the club, they would be sitting somewhere stern. A lot of people would just, we used to come in there, we'd be about six of us in drag, we'd walk through, and the younger queens would just settle in the corner and stare. And one night, I think Christina had just turned 17, she was up in the bar, and we came in, and she was just staring, and the other little young queen says, "Oh, don't go there where she is, she's mean." And I went over to the snack area, and they was telling her about, "Don't go there, she's mean." And I'm hearing all this through my ear. So Christina comes up, she tells them, she said, "Look, I don't know her, and I'm going to get to know her." So she came up, and she introduced herself. She said, "My name is Christopher Lee Smith. I'm from Lexington, Virginia, and I'd just like to meet you." So we sat back, and we talked and everything. And one night at the bar, she decided to put herself in drag. And, oh, honey, it was a mess. And here I am, standing up against the wall, watching the drag show, and here she comes through the door, his turn, and guess who she comes to? Straight to me. And I nearly had a conniption. So I got with her, and I taught her very well about drag and everything, and I started her. I made costumes, I did everything for her. On the first talent at the park, she won. But, you know, it just starts off like that. I mean, you know, you got some people that want to be helped. They don't mind, you don't mind helping, but you got those that think they're grand and lovely. I don't help them because they can't be helped. They cannot. They're too rude. I have two friends. One friend has been out doing drag for 4 years. Never accomplished nothing. Always a mess. You got this other queen that comes in, that's her cousin, has did drag for 2 whole years. This child has got titles on top of titles. This other queen, she paid for her titles. Like they had a pageant in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And she paid so much money to win the pageant. That's not good drag to me. You have to learn and you have to earn. You earn your working. You have to earn about being dragged. I mean, some people have it on Easy Street. And this child had been in drag for 4 years and still ain't accomplished nothing. And the other child came out in 2 years and she accomplished within 2 years this year. And she's beautiful now. She does drag. She's a former Miss Gay runner. She's got titles on top of titles. I got a daughter that lives in Atlanta, Georgia. And I met her when she was 18. She's doing real well. She's got titles on top of titles. And a lot of girls is like this. A lot of girls know how Roanoke is. They leave Roanoke to go out of town and make a name for themselves. Some of them, if you stay in Roanoke, you're not going to make nothing of yourself. When most of the ones that have left, they had to make something of themselves.
So would you say that Roanoke is not a place?
It's not Roanoke, it's the people. I mean, it's the different cliques. And that's what destroyed a lot of the girls, you know, because you got these different clique of people. Like, I was on stage when I performed at the park, and these boys making fun of me. And I was nice. I took him outside on the patio, and I put him in his place. I said, I tell you what, let's see you get up there in a dress. Now, I have seen this happen in Charlottesville. A queen was up there. She'd been doing Peddler Bear for many, many years. Excellent performer. She was on stage doing Patti LaBelle, and this guy in the audience was hollering, making fun of her. She looked at the owner of the bar. She said, I got this. She went out on stage, snatched him up, made him get on stage. She took her wig off and put it on him. And you know what she told him? Now, you get your out here and do it, and you better not miss a word. Now, he was embarrassed. Because it's always going to be that kind of person that's going to try to bring you down. And them the kind you give a hot ignore to. Yes, you do.
What? I think that this will definitely help, you know, get the drag history back out there and really open up for Roanoke community.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if the cliques and all that, everybody pull together, but they don't until they do, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be like it once is.
I think this is a great first step, and I would like to thank you very much for letting me
I
interview
you all.
Today.
I was nervous. I said, Lord, they're going to come. But, you know, I'm comfortable talking about it with you too, because, like I say, the word needs to get out there. I mean, they need to learn and stuff, but I'm happy I did it.
We're happy you did it too. It's great to have this story, so thank you.